Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 16th. The time is 1:34 p.m. Members present, Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Vice Chair, Representative Sadler, myself, Rep. Thompson, Co-Chair, Representative Newman, and Representative Gutenberg. I assume that Edgman and Munoz will show. Oh, Representative Edgman is here. Today we will be hearing an overview of the Department Permanent Fund Corporation. Presenting is Mike Burns, Executive Director, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation of the Department of Revenue, and also Laura Achie, Director of Communications and Administration, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, Department of Revenue. Please come forward and place yourselves on the record, and we'll hear your presentation.
Mr. Chair, I beg your indulgence early. I had some surgery. My throat's still pretty tender, so if I start to cough, I will recover. I got some drops and some water, so I make it through.
Yep, make sure you have some water there.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, well, I'm Michael Burns, Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund. And
I'm Laura Ashe. I'm the Director of Communications and Administration.
So we're very pleased to be with you and give you the overview today. I think the first slide we like to call just checkbook accounting, just from a historical perspective. You can see how much has been deposited in the fund, how much has been paid out, and what the current value of the fund is. So I hope you're pleased with the historical and the this social economic experiment that's now in its 30-some years. It's been very, very valuable for the state of Alaska.
Representative Munoz has joined us.
Thank you. The next slide is our last year's performance, our last fiscal year ending June 30th. You can see we're slightly behind our benchmark. somewhere between slightly and significantly less aggressive than a lot of our peers right now. We have less exposure to the equity market. We historically had probably about peer group, or if not higher, but have been trimming that back over the last 18 months. The market continues to run. That has run against us, but we think it's still a time to trim money from the equity market. And we're not talking about huge amounts, but it does hurt you when the markets, and you'll see what the equity markets did last year when you trim yourself back and they perform the way they have. What the number that's not up there, just on an accounting basis, our net income was $6.8 billion. Last fiscal year, so it was a very attractive year for us, we thought. Pardon me again. you can see our fund performance. Over these time periods, we are slightly below some of our benchmarks and median public funds. It's difficult to find who our peer groups are. This is largely public pension funds. I think if you really, where we're looking much more so to find comparable people and trying to benchmark ourselves, although it's difficult to get all the information we need, are really the sovereign wealth funds around the world. We're much more structured-like and are much more of a sovereign wealth fund. Matter of fact, we're the United States representative to an international group. The two members from the United States are us and the U.S. Treasury. So I think interacting with those people and learning from them is very important to us. I think let me just get a little water here. You can see this, what is principal, what is the earnings reserve, if you will, which is available for appropriation. The large yellow one is the traditional earnings reserve. The small slice is that portion of the earnings reserve that is credited to unrealized gains. This is a thing that we went through several years ago. The Department of Law said we needed to allocate it both ways. But that is, you add them together, and that's the earnings reserve. So you can see the fund is mostly principal today. if you look at our asset allocation, and take you back just a little bit through history, in the 80s, it was 100% in bonds, then we added stocks and real estate. When I say we, you added that authority to us in 2004, alternative assets. Most important thing, I think, in the evolution was in 2005 when the legislature removed the statutory investment list and authorized the trustees to invest in anything that was prudent. And I think it's opened up a lot of vistas for us. If you think about what the some of the real advantages of the permanent fund are, one of them is the ability to take a very long look. Hopefully we try to look over the horizon on some of the deals we're in. And I think not having a statutory investment list really augments that, so it allows us to play to one of our strengths more. Next, you can just see the yellow line is the earnings line, the effect of diversification, which in the investment world, we like to say diversification is the only true free lunch. We think we get some advantages from that, and we try to keep the portfolio balanced and the correlations. We manage those as best we can.
Representative Gaddis has joined us. Welcome.
As I said before, when we talked about the advantages of the fund, one is the time horizon we're able to look into. The other clearly is size. We're able to access the best investment managers in the world. People want to do business with us. We're trying very hard, and I think we've done it to develop our reputation with a lot of partners as a good partner, and we think that's a way to access excess returns for the fund. We're also large enough and in the forefront enough to be in the forefront of trying to bring down the costs of some of the fees that we pay. And I will tell you that there are very few businesses that are as attractive as managing somebody else's money for them. It's an expensive business, and I think we're bringing the cost down. I know we're bringing the cost down, but it's still very expensive. Our challenges, we're a long way from the financial centers, and recruitment from financial centers. When you talk about recruitment, staffing, it's a two-part thing. It's recruitment and retention. On the retention side, people have generally self-selected into the lifestyle here, whether they like the outdoors, they like the small town, they like this. So if we get them here, we have a pretty good chance of keeping them here. It's what we miss on the front end. We run an ad in the Wall Street Journal or some other trade journal, and people look at it and say, that's not for me. It's not a financial market. Even though some of the most interesting things in the financial markets are actually being done here or with us. So that is a challenge. Flexibility. And I mean this, and I want to say, we absolutely believe in legislative and executive oversight of what we do. There's no question. You know, the credibility of what we do is built, and the foundation of that is on the oversight that we have. That being said, the budget cycle doesn't always match up with the investment cycle. Opportunities can present themselves to us, and by the time they make it through the legislative process, which you're all painfully aware of how it can drag on or have its own life, they just don't match up very well. Small staff is a bit of a function of that budget process. We could do more. I know in the private sector, almost anything that you can outsource saves you money. In this business, it's just exactly the opposite. Anything that we can manage in-house is a factor of between 6 and 10 times cheaper than paying somebody in a money center to do it. That being said, you know, you can go broke very fast saving money. You want the best returns. So if we can get the talent, if we can get the people and get the returns, we can do it vastly cheaper than paying outside people. But it's a two-part thing. Was it a question? Uh-oh. We need not only, you know, the ability to hire additional people, but we have to be able to prove to you that we can do it. If we can, the savings are really substantial. And I would give you an example. A couple years ago, you authorized us to bring in, I believe, two or three people.
Two.
One to bring in a trader. Excuse me. To do international fixed income, and then we brought in a finance person because we had, you know, we were pretty well maxed out, and if we're going to bring fixed income in-house, we needed that. I think the two of those together was about a $300,000 budget increment with, you know, fully loaded. And thank you. I don't need oxygen tanks. But I appreciate it. Start traveling with a medic or corpsman. When we threw the switch and finally were able to bring that international fix, you know, make all the pieces fit together, that $300,000, I think, saved us at least $1.5 million, maybe $1.8 million.
Closer to $1 million, actually.
Yeah, in fees that we stopped paying somebody in London at the same time. And that's in fixed income, which has the narrowest margins. If you talk about some of other asset classes, the fees are much, much bigger than fixed income. So the savings are there if we can perform and if it can fit your budget. This is a quick look at our stock portfolio. That may look a little complicated. I think the red, the blue, and the green, I'm sorry, I won't do it that way. Three large types, domestic, international, and global. And the difference, obviously, domestic is U.S., international is non-U.S. Global managers can go either domestic or international at their discretion. And you can see the areas we invest in and the type of management, whether it's active, passive, or what we're moving to quite a bit now or in the process of is quasi-passive. And it's by far the most expensive is the active, by far the cheapest is the passive, and the quasi-passive is in between, although much closer to the passive. I won't get bore you too much with the detail, but a true passive, if you think of an S&P index account, that is a cap-weighted index, and we just you invest and you just try to be what the same capitalization as that index. If you're in the S&P, Apple goes up, you buy more Apple. So it's a momentum driven, and it can lead you to buy high, buy high, buy high, because as the pieces of that index get bigger, you buy, it becomes more of that, of what you're buying. Fundamental or quasi-passive can be structured in many ways, but you could have one that is set up by sales growth or margins or both. You know, what companies have, you know, are growing the fastest with maintaining margins. So it's a much how does their balance sheet look? So much more fundamentally oriented and tends to be a bit more of a value index. So it's a good, if you think of momentum as a growth index, this is a value. It gives us good balance, and that's what we're looking for all the time.
Mr. Burns, Representative Sadler has a question.
Yep.
Do you mind if we interrupt you during the process?
No, please.
Do we
have
questions? Thank you.
I want to make sure, Mr. Burns, I'm not reading too much into this chart that's not there. Each of those three concentric circles exist independently. In other words, there's no relationship between the passive being primarily up against non-U.S. Is that correct?
No, it's a vision.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
That would have been quite some trick.
Yeah. Although, yeah, it's actually, no, it's not at all.
It's not good.
Yeah, it's even contrary to that, actually. And just as I mentioned before, we have been a bit lighter in stocks over the last 18 months. Last fiscal year, the U.S. stock portfolio was up 27%. Non-U.S. was 20, and the global portfolio was up 25. So being a little under-allocated to stocks didn't help us. You know, we're not market timers, but we thought there was, you know, the market looked like it had a pretty good run, and it still continued to have a good run. There's an old saying in the business, you know, trees don't grow to the sky, and eventually there'll be a correction, and we're not trying to be like a stopped clock right twice a day. I mean, we do think there is a correction coming, and we'll be putting money back in at that time. We've had better luck in difficult times getting in than on these heady times about appropriately getting out. Back in 2009, actually March 9th, 2009, which turned out to be the low day of the market, and we weren't trying to pick the low day of the market. We thought the market looked awfully cheap. And if we'd have been within 90 days either way of the low day in the market, we'd have been very pleased with ourselves. We absolutely got the low day, which, I mean, just that's not our business to pick days like that, but we did. But we put $800 million into an S&P index account that's probably worth over $3 billion today. So getting in when things look the worst, we've been better at than getting out when things look great. And it's, if you go back to that time, once you got over the emotional issue of was the world coming to an end, then it became very obvious. We had to put money back in this market. It was, you know, we believe very strongly in reversion to the mean. So emotionally, it was a bit of a challenge. Intellectually, it was like somebody standing outside our front door with a big sign, do it now, you know, and it became. Right now, it's much more difficult. Almost everything in our portfolio is working very, very well, which would be the time you start to take things out of areas and put them someplace else. Everything's expensive. I mean, if everything in our portfolio is doing well, everything outside the portfolio is expensive. And so the challenge is, where do we put money today? We're doing some different things. We're buying real estate, excuse me, in Europe for the first time. We bought two shopping centers. I'm looking at two other ones. So, I mean, I don't think it's that far out on the risk profile, but it's different for us.
Burns, Representative Edgman has a question.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to ask how the price of oil globally has, and I think you just answered it. I was going to ask how it influenced your investing in the energy sector equities.
Contrary to how difficult this is for the state right now, it's been good for the markets. We also think, I guess we have to think of ourselves somewhat as firemen. You really have to run into the fire. I mean, that's our job. We are looking at energy strategies now to really, we think it's appropriate for us that energy isn't going to be in the doldrums like it is now. We have a lot longer time horizon to make that decision than you do. I mean, you know, we're not trying to fund a budget with the low end of it, but we're looking very hard right now at various energy things. We've got a fair amount of exposure already. We made some last year, kind of looking through that. Some of the deals that we made a year ago or maybe a year and a half ago, they take time. They're partnerships. It takes quite a while to get the money actually deployed. The money that is deployed, we're probably not going to do very well. Most of it is still not deployed, still looking for a home, and we like the looks of the homes now. You know, things are you know, attractive, and so and we're looking to put more money into the similar type deals. I can't tell you exactly what we're looking at, but it's not just more Exxon or more Chevron. It would be active partnerships. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
I show you just our top five stocks. I think we've always had that number there. The reason I have those there is I think it's important because we're doing a couple things or doing things a little bit differently, and I want to point that out. But if you remember just these range here of what these top five, because we have some very large or large positions in public companies today that are much larger than these, which is new to us. And this is more what you've traditionally looked at. So, and I'll return to that. Our bond portfolio, you can see it's, I don't know if there's any questions about it. That's the most challenging part of our portfolio today. Rates are incredibly low. Still incredibly low, and you don't want to reach out for yield, so you try to find your yield other ways. But you own bonds for different reasons other than just their yield, especially the treasuries. We own them in case there's a crisis, deflation, disinflation. So they have multiple uses in a portfolio, but this is challenging right now. this is how we're managing the portfolios inside, or no, I'm sorry, how it has changed over the last 2 years. I mentioned bringing in the international in-house, and most of that $12 billion, and I think externally managed today, we have specialty stuff. We have our high yield. We've got some mezzanine financing, private, public-private debt, but things that are more specialized than what we really do here. This what we do in-house is high-grade corporates, U.S. Issues, TIPS, and sovereign debt of developed nations, and some emerging market also. This is a map of where our real estate is located around the United States. We don't have the one of Europe added yet. And each dot doesn't necessarily mean one place. We have multiple ownerships in some of these. So it, and it's kind of hard to see. I think if you look there in Texas, I think that's a small 8. Or is it a 6?
It's a 6.
A 6, so that you won't be able to see it in this book. You can only see it up. But it's, that talks about 6 properties, residential properties that are there. And then next to it, there's a 2. Some of them are like up in Chicago. You can see just the bright green dot and the orange dot. One's a shopping center, one's an apartment building. But those are single unit deals. The portfolio itself, you can see.
Question from Representative Sadler.
Obvious curiosity, the one yellow dot for office building in Southeast Alaska, is that your headquarters?
Yes.
Okay, very good. You guys are.
The portfolio is structured like this. We are, I guess, aside from trying to invest some money overseas, we are trying to expand and have been actually for quite a while trying to expand the industrial side. I think with manufacturing getting somewhat of a rebirth in the United States, I think this will be easier. But over the last 10 years, that industrial slice has looked about like that as more and more manufacturing went overseas. Now we're starting to see it come back, so we think this will be more attractive. What we're looking at trying to find are intermodal things near ports. We think ports are very important to the future, and ones that have good rail connections and trucking connections are what we're looking at the best. Tyson's Corner, we've talked about that here many times over the years. We've been an owner of Tyson's at least 20 years. I think we started 25. With a
1985, and it was 14%.
14%. We're now 50% owner. We own for a moment 100% of it at one time, transition of ownership. But this is a new development. You can't see it very well, but behind those buildings now is completed metro, which comes from downtown. There's a station just outside of that picture. And if you look almost in the middle, that crosswalk below the first building on the left, that's the walkway from the metro right into the center. The building on the left is about 420 apartment units that should start leasing in April. The building in the middle is a 550,000 square foot office building that's about 80% leased. And the one on the right, 325, I believe, room hotel. And they're all clustered around this plaza, which is the entrance, the main entrance now to the shopping center. All the rest of that, which looks like ground, is the roof of Tyson's existing center, not all of it. Tyson's is about 2.2 million square feet of retail, so it's very large. But this new entrance that's about a $600 million development that we've been involved in for a number of years. And it was very difficult because all three of those buildings were built simultaneously, and the plaza, which from a construction perspective was very challenging. But you can only, this is a shopping center. People want to come here, and it can't be a construction site end to end to end. You get in, you build it, and you get out of there and let them go back and buy what they want. So we're very pleased with the way this is turning out. This is going to be, for this center, what in retail now they're talking about a live, work, play environment. But you can get on the metro there. You can be downtown, work downtown in less than 40 minutes. So we're excited about that. Simpson Housing, which we've, I think, talked about in here before, we're 50-50 partners in this with the state of Michigan. Actually, we're 48, they're 48, and the management has the balance. This is, when I say the state of Michigan, it's their retirement system. Simpson has about 20,000 apartment units around the country. When we were looking at that little circle that had a six in it in the Dallas area, that would have been probably mostly Simpson units. They do high quality. They build them, they manage them, and we sell them, you know, if the time is right. Probably the strongest suit they have of all those things, they run these apartments very, very well. Very impressed with them. And we've got almost $1 billion invested or at market, our share. Next couple of pages.
Andy, Representative Sadler has a question, Mr. Burns.
Mr. Burns, what is an LLLP? I know a limited liability partnership, but what's the extra L?
There's a third L in there.
What the?
I believe a misprint.
Okay. No, I copied it out of the annual report, but I don't know what that third L is
limited
either.
Limited liability partnership.
What? Limited liability, limited partnership? I don't know.
It's like Jeopardy.
I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Stump the man. Thank you.
We refer to it in all our stuff inside as SHLEP, which is S-H-L-P, which is, yeah. That may have been, I don't.
Maybe a typo all the way along.
Yeah, it may have been just repeated and repeated and repeated.
10-year typo?
Yeah.
Could be.
Continue.
Limited partnership.
What?
Limited liability, limited partnership.
Not a typo.
Oh, okay.
I am vindicated.
Case made for technology. Yes.
Thank you. I mean, and that may be under the state where that was created, how they do that. So everybody's right but me. So we
continue.
And now we're just, these are just some of the apartments. You can see the quality that we have. I'm just going to go through those. And, but they're in good, you know, good markets. Mm-hmm. When we bought in, I think we've been in this deal about 8 years now, maybe seven. I think the average age of the portfolio, and it's a bit like a running an airline, you know, what's the average age of your fleet? And I think we were at about 17 years, maybe not quite that high. Today we're at 11, and you've added those 6 years in there also. So, I mean, we really have upgraded this portfolio, grown it and upgraded it, and it's as good as any apartment portfolio, I think, in the United States. America Homes for Rent, I think we talked about it in here. This is a deal that we looked at. We recognized the opportunity, we thought, in the foreclosures that were going on all over the United States in single-family homes. thought there was an opportunity to buy homes, rent them out, and get a yield, which could help us offset what we weren't getting out of that fixed income portfolio that I talked about before. It would have been easy for five or six of us to each put in X amount of dollars and buy a bunch of homes, and we could have done very well. How you can do it on the scale that we needed to do it as a fund was the challenge for us. And we found some people in California who had been one of the early originators in mini warehouses, specifically public storage. And they were kind of removed from public storage now, but the founder was very interested in this same investment thesis that we were, that these opportunities for these single-family homes was really tremendous and to rent them out. So he put up personal money. He worth probably $5.5 billion himself. I mean, public storage did very well for him. So we had a partnership with him, and his people staffed it. We went to you know, all these foreclosure sales, bought them. He had other partnerships with others. We ultimately put them all together into a private real estate investment trust, which went public in June of 2013. Today, we've got almost 26,000 houses in 16 states in the public REIT. The value, and that gives us about a 24% interest in this public company, which is worth about $750 million. So you can see how much larger that is than the Apples and the other public things. But again, we're going to be in this for a while. We think this is a very attractive opportunity for us. The challenge, we were one of the early ones in the market. We were a fairly early mover in this, which served us very well, because all of a sudden, when institutional money decided they wanted to buy foreclosed homes, it got very active. And anything we bought yesterday was more attractive than what we bought today. And what we bought today was more attractive than what we bought tomorrow. So we're not as active in acquiring things now, but we had parameters. We've tried to figure out. We worked backwards from what we thought the rents could be. And, I mean, in some of these markets, the Las Vegas's, the Phoenix's, and that, you know, we were buying homes for $120,000 that had at one point been $500,000, you know. An interesting thing is, at the time, I don't know if it still holds true, about a third or close to a third of our renters were former owners. You know, they hadn't lost their job, but they were saddled with a mortgage that just, you know, they made no sense for them to ever pay off, they thought. They were still in the same job. They had picked this house because it was close to the schools where they wanted their kids to go. They wanted to stay in it, but they weren't going to pay off a $400,000 mortgage on something that we were going to buy for $120,000. So a lot of people are still in their home, and I think ultimately they may buy them back from us. You know, I mean, we're trying to see how this thing is going to develop. But we like this, and it's it's been a good investment for us. City Center, that's two. Okay, there's a three and a four, almost just like it. Mixed use in Houston, office retail. There's apartments around there. It's a very attractive area for us. Although with energy down. There was going to be a City Center 5, or 4 actually is on hold. No, 5 is on hold right now. We want to see. We still like the Houston market. We're looking at some medical stuff down there, but right now this is right in the energy corridor, and we'll give that a little time to see how that develops. This is a new apartment that we bought in Chicago within the last couple of years. It actually was built as a condominium. So it has very high-quality finishes, counters, appliances, and all that. We're looking at it entirely today as an apartment. If it ever goes back to being a condominium in the market, works, that'd be great. But it works very well for us as an apartment, and it would be a very nice bonus for us if it did become condominiums again. The shops at Northbridge, we have the same partner in this shopping center in Chicago. We've got about 8-9 blocks on Michigan Avenue, on Rush Street, Illinois. The buildings are separate. Some of them are attached, but it has one marketing theme. Nordstrom's obviously is the lead tenant. It's actually the best Nordstrom's in the country. Most of the time, it's between that and Seattle. But they're very proud. This is a much smaller store than Seattle. So it's very attractive. We have bought within the last 4 or 5 months a block next to this that right now is flat. There's an athletic club. It's used for surface parking. Has, for Chicago, I would say pretty much unlimited air rights above it. We're probably not going to go that high. We'd like to put some underground parking, attach it, make this center bigger, have underground parking, retail, maybe some residential above that, and then if someone wants to build a high-rise hotel above it with the air rights, that's probably more of their line of business than ours. But again, that's the same partner we have in Tyson's. Non-U.S., Warrington, which is in the outskirts of London, and a shopping center in Alicante in Spain, looking at other Spain, Portugal, and Warsaw right now. This, we were talking about the challenges. If you go back to 1998, when we had exactly the same size staff, real estate-wise, we had 1.2 billion real estate assets managed by the same number of people. You know, today we have 5.9 billion managed by the same staff size. However, if you look at the difference in the blue lines, the blue lines are things that we really owned or had a majority interest in. So we were really a minority partner. Today, you know, our ownership structure has changed dramatically. Most of the things we're in, we're the owner. So we're doing, with the same number of people, the complexity is much higher and the dollars are much bigger. So we're looking for help. Mm-hmm. And that's absolute return. These are basically our hedge funds. We're in the lowest risk area, absolute return, of the hedge fund thing. This is primarily a risk reducer, and we're looking to make some changes to this program probably during the next year. We've got 270 hedge fund managers. That's too many, so we're going to be really trying to trim that back. The gatekeepers, if you will, are fund to funds, and they do the hiring and firing of that. But we're just too many, too small to have any real insight into what they're doing and also to get any fee breaks. We're just another customer. So we're going to be looking to concentrate that. Infrastructure. This is probably a five-year-old asset class for us, maybe a little six at the most. Think of infrastructure primarily. It is assets that are either owned by or regulated by government. They have high barriers to entry, things that governments are trying to sell to raise money for other purposes. It can be, you can see water and wastewater, transportation, airports, ports, energy. We have some pipelines. So it's not a big high yielding thing. You think of it more of a solid base for your portfolio, like your real estate. Is there a question?
Burns, Representative Guerra has a question.
Thank you. Mr. Burns, we're not asking a ton of questions, because I think most of us are focused on the fiscal crisis, and this isn't money that we're using, though that's of big interest to Alaskans. And I guess my only question so far really is why – so hedge funds are a hedge against the market, right? That's a way too simple way to say it. But – yeah, why did it take so long to realize that 270 hedge fund managers are too many? It seems like of those 270, so many of them working at cross purposes. It's like overly it's diversified.
It becomes an index fund.
Right. Yeah.
When we got started in this business, in that business, was back just about when I started, 10 or 11 years ago. And it was kind of an edgy name out there.
Mm-hmm.
So the trustees took, you know, let's just take the worst case that came up, Madoff. You know, it blew up and hurt a lot of people. We weren't in Madoff, but what they wanted was to have enough small investments that if one blew up, it was $18 million, not $350. You know, and to really learn that business, having that kind of diversity. But as it's turned out, the cross purposes that you talked about, it's if there was an ETF or an index for absolute return, we would have been in. I mean, you end up getting about the average of the market. Because with that many, I think we say 277. I think that's a little high. Actually by maybe a third. I think it's still way too many. You know, we're still. But it was that comfort that we took when we started in having a lot of small pieces that if they blew up, it wasn't front page news.
Thanks, and Mr. Chair, I think all Alaskans do appreciate the one publicly traded real estate investment trust that we might all look at, but I guess we can't invest in any of the other ones.
Continue.
Some of the things that in private equity, I'm not going to get too far into this.
I think this is infrastructure.
Infrastructure. If we can hire more people in infrastructure deals and private equity primarily, since we've been involved, we have always negotiated the right to what is called co-invest. We haven't taken advantage of co-investment up until just the last couple years because we didn't have the people. You know, we've gotten a couple people. We're doing some co-investment. Let me explain it. If we're in a infrastructure partnership and the partnership says, document says, we can't put, as a partnership, we can't put more than $250 million into a project. And we might be 10% of the fund, so that's $25 million, yep, that we have in it. But to get the deal, it's a $400 million investment. They can go back to the partners like us and say, do you want to co-invest with us? In other words, you've got $25 million in it under our banner. Would you like to put $25 in it directly, you know, your own? Why would you want to do that? Well, one, you think it's a good project because you're in it already. You hope it's a good project, but you're in it already. The biggest thing is there's no fees on co-investment. So you cut your fees absolutely in half. And it may not be limited to what you have in it. If you've got 25 in through the partnership, maybe you want to put 100 in a co-investment. But it's without fees. So that's one of the ways I talked earlier about how we're trying to bring fees down. Co-investment is very attractive to us. It takes a lot of time. And this is more, where is that?
Yeah, I know which one you want. That one.
Yeah. This is on private equity and co-investment. I'm not sure what this is, or is it both?
This is just private equity.
Private assets.
Yeah.
Total.
This is for David.
This is about what these people workload for the year looks like. They get 60 opportunities. They really take a hard look at 12 of them. And last year we closed 6. Yeah. So there's a lot of time, a lot of thought given into these, this co-investment. And it's not necessarily just co-investments. Some of them are direct investments where, you know, people come to us and say, do you want to be in this? Now, we have the ability through our budget, there's a line item for third-party fiduciary services where if we get close on something like this, you know, we might go out to these third-party fiduciaries and say, we think we like this. Our partner, you know, that's running our partnership likes it. What do you think? Now, that is a belt and suspenders and more suspenders or more belts. I mean, that's about as cautious. There are people in this business and highly thought of institutional investors that just tell their partnerships, if it's good enough for you, it's good enough for us. If there's a co-investment opportunity, count us in. We're not there. That's a long way from our thinking. But we may be overly cautious at this point. But we that's the opportunity. That's why we need people. Private equity, you can see we've implemented the co-investment here. We're in primarily in the U.S. And we like private equity. It's one of the reasons our public equity is lower compared to others. For our purposes, we add the private equity back into it. Although this has a higher return or expected return for us in our planning purposes than public equities, but it's a longer payoff. You're in a bit longer. But this can be buyouts, it can be spin outs, all kinds of things that companies no longer want to be in this business. And it may not make sense for DuPont to be in the agricultural chemical business, but it's an attractive business on its own. Private equity people come in and would buy it from a DuPont. I don't want to get any calls from DuPont, but just by example. But we do like private equity, and again, it has that co-investment opportunity for us. Special opportunities is an asset class. No, I'm sorry. It's not an asset class. It's what we call a bucket, and it's basically it can be divided into two parts. One is we think something in the market is showing us an opportunity that isn't going to be around a long time, but it is a special opportunity to earn additional yield than the market is giving on most things. Or we can look at it, it's a special opportunity for us to reduce risk. Historically, we've been more on the risk reduction side than the yield enhancement side. We're changing that around. America Homes for Rent was a special opportunity. That's where it fit into our portfolio. It's now part of our real estate portfolio, but because once it matured, but as we were putting it together, we managed it as a special opportunity. one of the things, it's a public company, but again, it's the same type of thing with America Homes for Rent that really kind of dwarfs the Apples and the other public companies. I think about 15 months ago, we started discussions with the Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, Children's Memorial in Seattle, and Sloan Kettering in New York, where they would put their science in. They were all doing similar things. They'd put their science in. We'd put some money in and see if we could put together a company that could come up with some real answers on some types of cancer. The company, this all happened. Getting people together wasn't the hard part. It's the intellectual property. Did everybody have the right to operate? Whose patents? You know, was Merck already in something, or was Pfizer, or the University of Pennsylvania, or somebody else? Got a pretty clear path to what we wanted to do. The company went public the Friday before Christmas, just this last year. I think we had about $130 million in it. We now have about 25 million plus shares. The company is called Juno Therapeutics. It's traded on the public markets. It's J-U-N-O. They kind of gave a nod to us with the name Juno, but Juno is also, I believe, the Greek god of healing. But it's the name of the company. It's trading, I think, about $40 a share. Today it got as high as 60. So if you take our 25-plus million shares times $40, you're over $1 billion in market value. So it's been very attractive for us. Now, that's not our business as usual type thing. I mean, a lot of things came together that in 99% of the deals, they don't come together. This one just kept, you have a path to what you want to do. There are gates along the way, and if you can't get past the gates, that's the end of it. These gates just kept opening, so it's been very attractive for us. And the clinical results, I don't want to get into those here, are absolutely stunning. If you want to read about them, you Google them, and it's eye-popping what they've been able to do on certain types of cancer. So we're very excited about that, and that was a special opportunity, and very special. These are direct fund investments. I guess if we can do things directly, you can kind of see the difference in cost. If we go directly through the industry, the fees are 1.5% and 20% of the profit over 5 years. If we can do it directly, it might be $500 million, again, at the same, but then $500 million free, and we might get part of the revenue share out of the partnership if we can structure that. The ability to structure things differently and take pieces of deals is very important to us. But again, it takes the staff to do something like that. We looked at the private assets. We're certainly not going to spend any time or any explanatory time on my part. I just wanted to show you the complexity of the financial networks that we have. As we ask for help with financial networks from you, it fits into this. It's important to us, and I think you can see how these, and we are separate from the state. Accuracy and security are vitally important to us. So I think we have a request in for... No, okay, I'm sorry. But that's just...
Oh, yeah, through the budget process.
Yeah.
Some requests, yeah.
Last thing I wanted to talk about, because I think there were some questions about the dividend. You probably all have looked at these numbers, but 2009, which is a very difficult time, as we all remember, fell out of the budget calculation, the dividend calculation. That's why the dividend jumped so much. 2014 was a very good year for statutory net income, but losing the negative number changed things dramatically. As we look out in the future, I think the dividend ought to be about flat.
For the next several years?
Yeah. How the dividend is calculated, I don't know if we want to spend any time.
It's there for reference.
Yeah. The other thing, we get a lot of questions, are just oil prices and the dividend, and changes in oil prices find their way into the formula, but very slowly. It's not anything that hops anything up. It gives us more money to invest, and if we're successful in investing, and then reap returns from those, it's helpful.
So. Mr. Burns, Representative Wilson has a question.
Mr. Chair, I just have one. On the dividend calculation, is the calculation, is that done through statute or regulation?
Statute.
Okay, thank you. That's what I thought. I just want to make sure.
The only two things that regulate the permanent fund that are not statutory, that the, those things that are contained in the Constitution, is the at least 25% royalties and the concept of principal. Those are contained in the Constitution. Everything else is statutory.
Mr. Burns, I think it was in the late 80s or maybe the early 90s, there was a change where through statute, I think that they started, instead of 25%, it went to 50%. Is there any of that still left, or is it all back to the 25% constitutional requirement?
Representative Thompson, those statutes are still active. It's only 50% royalties on certain fields. The net effect is that we get about 30% total of the royalties and lease payments that come to the state. So there was a period of time where there was a bill passed probably about 6 or 7 years ago now that reduced that number back to 25. But there was a trigger in there, and it had to do with when it would start to affect the dividend at a certain point, and that trigger was reached. And so it reverted, it sunsetted, and so those statutes are now back in effect. And so on those fields, we're getting 50% of the royalties into the permanent fund.
Okay. Continue.
This is concludes our presentation, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Questions from committee, Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Got a pretty quiet atmosphere here. So we're looking at a huge deficit here in the state of Alaska. And as I say, all things can be on the table. And a question, I guess, my own personal edification. If you were to looking at the last 5 years on page 34, if you were to sort of find the mean in those five numbers and back out inflation proofing and the money for dividends, what might be available in terms of revenues for other uses?
Well, the mean would be $2.5
billion. Yeah, I think if you go back to that chart, maybe
that one.
That's statutory net income. And that's different than net income. If you remember when I was talking about 2014, our accounting net income was $6.9 billion, mm-hmm. which includes unrealized gains also. Statutory net income only includes realized gains and losses and realized capital gains mm-hmm. and losses. Mm-hmm.
Follow-up question, Representative Edmund.
So to drill down just a little bit more and get more specific, then take that to the earnings reserve. If you put aside your statutory obligations for the earnings reserve, which include the dividend, if I'm not misinformed, and as well as inflation proofing of the fund itself, what, and I know you can't give me a typical year because you know, events fluctuate from 1 year to the next in terms of earning performance. So, you know, we can only just sort of point to that anecdotally. But I'm trying to get a sense of, you know, this past year you had the fund had a good year. The principal, according to slide, one of the first couple of slides, the corpus itself is at $44 billion. Is that accurate? The slide we have in front of us, $45 billion. You've got 7.8 in the earnings reserve at this point. The dividend, if you could help me understand what the dividend amount requirement of that is and what the inflation-proofing amount is out of that chunk of money up there.
If you assume that the dividend was flat going out in the future, I think last year the dividend was right about $1 billion.
Yeah, it's on that last slide.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So the So it's $1.25 billion is what was paid to the dividend for FY14. In addition, off the top of my head, I think inflation proofing is running about $800 million, but I could be off on that. I haven't.
We can give you the inflation proofing is a kind of a peculiar process because it's the rate of inflation is figured as of the end of December, but it's applied to the fund at the end of the fiscal year. So we have that number, so we can make estimates of what the size of the fund is. I just don't, off the top of my head, have that, what we did in inflation proofing last
year. I think
it's
about, it's been running about $800 million the last several years.
So maybe $2 billion.
So, Mr. Chairman, a
follow-up.
To follow up then, to use that as a rough number, $2 billion in terms of your statutory obligations, is that a proper way to put it?
All things being equal, it's difficult right now to say. It's still pretty early in the year, but that's probably pretty close.
And if I were to ask what a
go ahead
a normal earnings year would be like for a fund that looks to be very well diversified and really built to withstand a lot of different pressures at different parts of the globe, and I think a pretty impressive portfolio for what I know of investment portfolios.
Long-term goal of the trustees, the stated goal right now for the earnings for the fund is 5% real, which is 5% after inflation, which is a little bit heftier than most pension funds are running right now. And we're not overly concerned about that being a little heftier because it's not driving a lot of behavior. If we were a pension fund and we're sitting here and telling you we're going to make 5% real and therefore you're making judgments on how much you're going to appropriate, you know, into the pension, then you got to think about it a lot. So what you do, what we do, isn't affected a whole lot by that 5%. If we were going to use that number for something, I think we'd want to think about that quite a bit before, you know. But it's not. It's a little.
Follow up, Representative Edgman. Keep going.
Well, so the permanent fund, the corpus itself is invested as a long-term endowment, right? You're looking for long-term returns.
Right.
You're looking for performance that isn't reactive to events throughout any particular cycle, year or otherwise.
That's the plan.
So if you're able to inflation-proof the fund, you're able to maintain the dividend of the population of 641,000 or so Alaskans, I think I saw one of the slides, give or take, and that number seems to be coming up a little bit every year. You're generating additional monies beyond those two requirements. And so I'm trying to get some ballpark number, and I think you partially answered it just a moment ago, that if some of those additional funds were to be used for other purposes, you would in turn, or the board would in turn, the trustees would in turn begin managing the portfolio in a different manner for different outcomes. Is that accurate characterization?
If it was an ongoing program that X amount or X percent, I think it would depend on what the percent was, what we'd have to think about. We have really awfully good liquidity within the fund. At the same time, I say the greatest strength we have is the ability to invest long term. And those are quite different attributes. Right now, I wish we had more invested long-term and less liquidity, but we can't find homes for that money long-term. If we were paying out, you know, on a regular basis to the general fund, or I think what you're talking, we'd have to look at that. I don't think it would change it dramatically. And I just add one thing. This is a personal editorial note. I think If you go back to the beginning of the fund, you've talked twice about inflation proofing. I think when the fund was invested 100% in bonds, inflation proofing was one of the smartest things we could have ever done. I think there's a discussion to be had today with the asset allocation and the asset mix that we have. Are we inflation proofing by asset allocation? I mean, with this money invested in equities that should grow with the market, in real estate that should grow with the market, in a lot of these things that should grow, is that inflation proofing in and of itself? Do you need the other? That's not a decision that's on this side of the table. That's your side, but I think it's worth thinking about.
Representative Wilson, then Representative Guerra, then Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So assigned, and maybe I missed the assigned earnings reserve. What exactly is that?
I think if you just, it's really the earnings reserve. They changed the accounting groups. I can't think of the governing groups. Changed the way we needed to refer to things. So historically, if you go back to the earnings reserve in principle, how we reported things. Today we call them their assigned funds, but it's really the earnings reserve for your purposes.
Go ahead.
And maybe I'm wrong here, and I don't know if this question you can answer, but to me, when the permanent fund was initially set up, I would imagine the way it was set up that at some point, knowing that oil, as soon as it's found, starts decreasing in volume, not even taking the price into consideration. So as the permanent fund was set up, do you know whether or not there was ever a portion of that was potentially to be used for general funds, considering we know that at some point oil, maybe not today, but down the line, would no longer exist? Was there anything put here to know that maybe a percentage would be used for that purpose?
I think the closest you can come to that is in the ballot proposition that created the permanent fund. They talked about a rainy day account, but it's pretty vague. I mean, it talks about that, but what the ultimate use of this fund was never entirely determined at its creation. It may not have been created if it was entirely done. Who knows the history there?
Yeah.
There's still some history to be made about what the role of this fund is in a fiscal crisis or oil being depleted. Maybe those are the same fiscal crisis, there is not a clear roadmap. The roadmap to how this fund will be used in the future will be determined by you and your colleagues.
May I add something?
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think this, too, will partially answer your question. The constitutional language directs that all earnings of the fund go to the general fund, and it was the policy of this body that changed that in the early 1980s, and so that those yellow pie pieces are in there because of your decision, and so it's within your scope to decide whether or not to appropriate them or to even reverse that statutory language.
So one last follow-up.
Follow-up.
I think she got to where I was talking about. Because we talk about Norway a lot and how they do theirs. So if that had not been changed, would the bigger yellow, because the smaller yellow piece, I'm assuming, is their dividends, and the bigger yellow one is what got changed, is the statute you're talking about that was changed that may have continued to have gone into the general fund if we had not changed it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, without getting too deep into permanent fund inside baseball,
right.
the smaller yellow wedge is part of the unrealized income
on
the fund. It's the part that is attributable to the earnings. So that those funds would have gone to the general fund. Overall, certainly the fund itself would be smaller, mm-hmm. those earnings would be smaller because they remain in the fund. They're earning more money. That's what that smaller yellow wedge is. They're earning more money. They're growing on their own because they're staying with the permanent fund.
And so if we could, if you, you know, Mr. Chair, would be, if there's any way to figure out what that might have been, if it hadn't been changed, I don't know whether you can do that or not. And if you can't, that's okay. But
to follow Norway?
No.
I mean, or to any
other. But if we had not changed
if we left, if we'd sent the earnings back to the general fund, through the chair representative.
Or if we had reversed, I guess the better question is, if it was reversed today, what would that look like for next year?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, unfortunately, we're never in a position where we can do look-backs because there's too many variables. I mean, if the question is, what would it look like next year if we took, you know, $7.8 billion out of the fund, we could look at that. It would be significant.
Yeah, I just think that's one of those questions that we've been being asked, you know, what it would look like. So I know you can't go backwards, but forwards, if that were to be reversed, it'd be nice just to have that.
Representative Guerra and then Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just on the earnings reserve, correct me if I'm wrong, the biggest purposes of the earnings reserve are to have enough money for the dividend and to inflation proof. Is that correct? Okay. Go ahead.
Assuming they have a purpose other than they are created by accounting, I mean, that's their use. I don't know if it's a purpose, and maybe I'm putting too fine a point on that.
Fair enough. Through the chair, right now, as of today, it looks big, but back in 2008, 2009, we were at the point where the earnings reserve was so small that people were talking about the possibility that we couldn't pay our dividend without drawing from the general fund. I mean, sometimes it looks too big, sometimes it looks too small. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then just one final question, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
And I'm not guessing what's going to happen on the stock market. You mentioned that you're bracing for a correction, but you don't know if a correction is going to come. But I suppose if a correction came in the stock market, then the earnings reserve would start to shrink again. Is that a fair assumption?
If we had to realize net losses.
Yeah, if you started realizing net losses.
All right. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. So in understanding the percent of market value theory, that would take 5% of the value of the fund, and half of that would go toward the dividend, and the other half would go, no? Could you explain it to me?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz. The board's proposal is simply to go to an average of 5% over the market value of several years. How that 5% would be decided is beyond our scope. That would be for this body to decide.
And 5%, we're talking about 5% of the core
average of the total value. So $52.54 billion, except that it's actually 5% of the value over 5 years. So it would be not 2% of $52.4 billion, but 5% of the average value over 5 years.
But as I spoke earlier, whether 5% would be the right number today, it was a number of years ago, but interest rates are so much lower today that 5% may be an aggressive number. But I said it's not driving our behavior. But if it was going to be a number that drove our behavior, I think we'd all want to look at it, make sure that was the kind of number that we could be comfortable
follow
with.
Follow up, Representative.
5% today would be roughly about $2 billion. Is that correct?
$2.5 billion.
So it would generally cover what we're paying for dividend plus the inflation proofing now.
Well, through the chair, Representative Munoz, through a POMV proposal put forward by the board, inflation proofing would go away because it would be inherent in the asset mix of the fund and in the way that the 5% rides up and down with the value of the fund over time. So you would no longer make an inflation proofing transfer.
I understand that, but it would be more or less equivalent to what we're paying today with inflation proofing.
Yeah, pretty close, yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burns, there have been various proposals in the past to create the permanent fund dividend as a constitutional amendment obligating the state to pay a dividend. There is current legislation introduced this year to do that. Would you have any thoughts on that, or does the board have a position on putting the permanent fund dividend in the Constitution?
Do I have any thoughts? The board I don't think has ever taken a position on that. I think our role is to do these investments as best we can, as prudently as we can, so that you as policymakers have as much to work with as possible. And I think the question probably, as opposed to being directed to the board, I think that's the kind of question, there's a lot of people you ought to ask. I think off the top of my head, I think I'd start with the rating agencies. You know, the rating agencies give quite a bit of credit to the state of Alaska for the permanent fund. If the only use of the permanent fund was to pay dividends, would they have that same support if it was constitutionally directed, you know, to just pay dividends? I don't know that they'd be so favorable. You know, what can it do? You know, the permanent fund can do a lot to help the state if the state needed it to or not. If you get into some of these other things and take away that flexibility. So I'd start there, but I'm not sure that's an appropriate topic for the board.
Okay.
Or me, I guess, probably.
Fair enough. Well, to follow up on that, then.
Hold up, Representative Sadler.
You mentioned the rating agencies. Who else might we want to ask should that question arise? For the record, I think it's a poor idea. I'll just put it out there. But who else would want to?
I'd have to think about that a little bit. The rating agencies were the first ones that came to my mind. It kind of reminds me of my days as a banker. Someone comes in and keeps talking about having this rich uncle, but if the rich uncle isn't signing on the note, it's just interesting information. If you had a permanent fund that was only could do one thing, and that was to pay dividends by constitution, kind of like the rich uncle that won't sign.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Burns, Ms. Achie. And it is, well, let me go into this. We'll next meet tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We'll have statewide oil and gas production tax credits presentation by Analytica. And then tomorrow afternoon at 1:30 p.m., we'll have Alaska LNG Project by Lazard Interim Report. And with that, at 2:55 p.m., we are adjourned.